Yesterday in The Hague, the U.S. and its closest allies ousted Russia from the group of eight industrialized countries. That's to punish President Putin for the annexation of Crimea. They also threaten tougher sanctions if Putin escalates aggression against Ukraine. And there's concern over the buildup of Russian forces on Ukraine's border. Meanwhile, Ukraine withdrew armed forces from Crimea, citing Russian threats to military staff and their families. Retired Colonel Dealey Gable is a former attaché to the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. He now lives in Watertown. And on Thursday evening, the South Dakota World Affairs Council is sponsoring a talk from Colonel Gable at the Brookings Public Library. And he joins us on the line. Lee, thanks for joining us on Dakota Midday.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, looking at the events over the past couple of weeks, how surprising was it to you that Russia annexed Crimea so soon after Ukraine President Yanukovych was ousted? I mean, if you just go back a month ago, Crimea was part of Ukraine. Was there any inkling that Putin had designs on the peninsula before?
Well, I would say that they've been making motions and statements to the effect that there's a need to protect Russian ethnic Russians within Ukraine and Russian speakers, making the case that somehow the rights of that population was being discriminated or they were being denied in some way. Having been to Crimea myself several times, the only thing I could think of would be that it might be mildly irritating to have to read an advertisement in Ukrainian if you're a Russian speaker, and that's about the only thing I can see. So, yes, to some extent, we should have expected this, I think, in the West, that Russia might do something using the pretext to protect ethnic Russians and Russian speakers, particularly in Crimea, because that's the only part of Ukraine where more than half of the population is ethnic Russian.
Why don't you think the U.S. was more prepared for this to happen, that they could have anticipated that Russia would annex Crimea?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say it has to do a lot with other things that we're involved in, most particularly Afghanistan. There's also a tendency, I think, for us in the West to expect. And this is an interesting thing. I think what you're seeing going on here is two streams of history emerging. And you can if you look back at Ukrainian history, if you look back at Russian history, you see a case where Ukraine's national identity is kind of coalescing around the idea that they should be able to determine their own fate. And that's a very Western kind of thinking, that the self-determination, rule of law, those are all good things. Well, but from a Russian perspective, it's not the same thing. It's more of the old world thinking, the zero-sum thinking. And I think it has something to do with the fact that in the Western world, we've become accustomed to the rule of law, that a country doesn't necessarily have to hold territory in order to protect the rights of people there, but there are ways to engage other countries so that they, for example, in the case of Russia wanting to protect the rights, the minority rights of ethnic Russians in Crimea or the rest of Ukraine, there are ways that they can use the rule of law, the rule of international law, if you will, to make a case that Ukraine maybe needs to do something different to protect or to see that the ethnic Russians are not discriminated against. And so when we kind of have that Western mindset, it's less likely that we're going to expect other countries to behave in kind of that old zero-sum thinking, where that all-or-nothing thinking, where we need to have a sphere of influence to control what happens there. If you think 1700s Russian history, we need to actually own the territory to make sure nothing bad happens there. So I think in some ways it's a clash of worldviews, and that causes us to think differently, to expect different things from different countries.
Have we misunderstood Russia then over the past couple of decades since the fall of the Soviet Union, thinking that Russia wanted to be a Western country, or at least much more closely aligned with the West?
I think to some extent, yes. And there was a bit of euphoria, and I think you can say that Ukraine did as well. If you look at the, I'll go back to it in a minute, to the Budapest Memorandum of 1984. But I think, yes, with Gorbachev and Yeltsin, there seemed to be a willingness to accept little bit of Russian thinking. They were accepting Russian assistance. But in the end, by the time Putin came into power, things were different. And they started to kind of, I would say, go back to the old thinking. And that, you know, if you look at Russian history, if you go back and look at what Russia suffered with Mongol invasions, with invasions from Napoleon, et cetera, you know, there's a need, or there's kind of a natural feel that they need to somehow secure their Russian homeland. And so I think we didn't quite understand that that could be kind of the reflex, the historical reflex that Russia would have kind of as a country. But we were a bit spoiled, perhaps, by what seemed to be a more receptive to the West mindset on the part of Gorbachev and Yeltsin.
Now, you mentioned the Budapest Memorandum.
Yeah. That was, as you probably studied or you've heard about it in the news, the Ukrainians are kind of looking to the West to do something about this based upon the Budapest Memorandum. And what that was, in 1994, the Clinton administration, the British government, and the Russians all agreed that if Ukraine would give up their nuclear weapons, and at that time, that was after the fall of the Soviet Union, that was the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, if Ukraine would give up their nuclear weapons and sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, then the U.S., the United Kingdom, and the Russians would not do anything to harm the territorial integrity, sovereignty of Ukraine. So Ukraine lived up to their agreement. Russia did not, as it turned out. They did something to harm territorial integrity of Ukraine. And I found an interesting quote from Stephen Pfeiffer, one of the negotiators of the treaty. He was also the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine in the mid-90s. This was on CNN. He said that it's up to the other two signatories, so the other two assurers in the 1994 memorandum, that's namely the U.K. and the U.S., to do something to penalize Russia.
Well, what can the U.S. and the U.K., the Western countries, do about the situation between Russia and Ukraine? Is the sanctions, ousting Russia from the G8, does any of that make much difference?
I'm afraid it probably won't make a lot of difference unless we're really willing to make some hard choices along with our European partners in terms of economic sanctions. So those would take some sacrifice. And I'm not an economist, but you can imagine it's going to take some sacrifice on the part of Western financial institutions to really turn the economic screws on Russia. So that's one thing, but that's hard to find the will to do that. The other thing is, from the U.S. standpoint alone, what appears to me to be happening is the sanctions are very limited at this point, and that's, I would guess, that's to so that the U.S. can preserve some leverage. They're not doing everything that they can possibly do at once, because outside of military action, which I don't think is really an option for the U.S., and it's probably not being considered in any great way in NATO, is not really an option to deal with this, and it's not really required by the 1994 memorandum.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Our guest is retired Colonel D. Lee Gable, former attaché to the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. He now lives in Watertown, but he'll be in Brookings Thursday evening. He'll give a talk at the Brookings Public Library, talking about the situation in Ukraine. That's sponsored by the South Dakota World Affairs Council. Looking at the situation, are we seeing a geopolitical realignment here?
Well, maybe. This is, I think it's kind of been a slow-moving train for you know, since Ukrainian independence. And I think we're seeing that kind of play itself out. And this is, and depending on how we want to see it play out, if we want if you call this kind of the successor to the Cold War, if we want to see that line drawn in eastern Ukraine, well, we're going to have to be active. And to finish the previous thought, as the eastern Ukraine as opposed to the border of western Ukraine, if we wanted to see Ukraine have their opportunity for self-determination and to truly live by the rule of law and applying all those Western values, then we were talking about short-term sanctions just a minute ago. I think what we need to do is take a more long-term strategy of assisting Ukraine to establish itself as a country ruled by laws. And I think one thing that listeners, I think, should be aware of is that over the decades of Ukrainian independence, the U.S. and the West have been given a lot of aid, a lot of foreign aid to Ukraine. At one time in the mid-90s, the levels of aid to Ukraine were on the level of, close to the levels of, where I should say, only second to the levels of aid to Egypt and Israel. And at this point, it appears that the Ukrainian government truly seems to be much more receptive to that kind of aid and the mindsets that where you know, the principles of democracy, principles of rule of law. One of the things I got to work in when I was stationed in Ukraine was working with the Ukrainian military and how to think in a Western way, how to make decisions in a Western way, how to be a military in a democracy. And so those kinds of that I think is kind of a long-term strategy that the West should take in trying to the way we do Marshall Plans in the modern day with our agencies such as the U.S. Agency for International Development.
Ukraine currently has an interim government. Elections are coming up in May. What are the challenges facing the government right now, the interim government, and then the future after the elections?
I think the main thing facing there's two things that I see. The first is for the interim government is to deal with the issue of corruption. We hear a lot about how corrupt Ukraine is, and it was under the previous government. Well, a lot of those tendencies date back within the Ukrainian bureaucracy at all levels, date back to the Soviet Union and even before that to when part of Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire. And so that's the first thing. It takes a lot of strong leadership to deal with that. One other thing that kind of scares me personally is there are some nationalist tendencies. You may have seen some of the things in some of the news reporting about some of a neo-Nazi type mindset or anti-Semitic type mindset or a Ukraine for Ukrainians type mindset. And there are Ukrainian politicians, particularly there is one party in Ukraine called Svoboda, which simply means freedom in Ukrainian. That party does have ministers in the interim government. Some of the leaders of that party have made some anti-Semitic statements. So I think dealing with that kind of mindset, the integral, the negative kind of nationalism, so not just purely patriotism, but the negative kind of nationalism, could be something that proves to be very difficult for the interim government to deal with, or the government that's elected in May.
What's the point of view of the average Ukrainian in what's going on? Do we have much of an idea of what the general population is thinking regarding what's happening?
Well, when we were talking to some of our Ukrainian friends on Skype last week, they said, make sure you tell everybody in America that Ukrainians are united by spirit of battle. So that's the best translation. So in other words, it sounds like it's having a unifying effect for the most part, on Ukrainian society. And kind of going back to the whole issue, I don't think most Ukrainians have a nationalist, a Ukraine for Ukrainians kind of attitude, but they see them because they have a lot, there's a lot of Ukrainians with Russian heritage, there's a lot of Ukrainians with Jewish heritage. It's predominantly Ukrainian, but there's a lot of mix in there. And so it's more Ukraine as a country pulling together is what I see in general. And I just wanted to clarify that I don't think most Ukrainians see things from a Ukraine for Ukrainians perspective.
The loss of the Crimean Peninsula, is that something they feel strongly? Given that it's only been a part of Ukraine since what, about 1954, when Khrushchev added it to Ukraine.
I think, in fairness, I think the views are going to be different from Ukrainian to Ukrainian. I think most Ukrainians probably understand the fact that, yes, 1954 is when Crimea became part of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, but they do feel like, I think they've learned kind of a tough lesson. There was still a tendency that wasn't kind of a really big deal because there is some cultural affinity between Ukrainians and Russians. And a bit of a a feeling of betrayal on the part of what they thought was a neighbor that was not likely to do this. I think that's kind of the feeling within the general populace. Now, there are some Ukrainians, it just depends on who you talk to, just like in any country, differing opinions that run the gamut where we should have been expecting this. Others that would say, well, like you suggested, no big deal, perhaps. But in general, I think it's more of a sense of betrayal on the part of a neighbor that, it was something they either wanted to put out of their mind,